Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:45 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is November 4th, so today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and we've had a big upward dynamic today in gold, silver, copper, oil. So this is significant, and it's certainly whiff. The smells of an all change moment for commodities, and it raises more questions than answers, unfortunately. But certainly, when we look at the internal dynamics of the range, we've had two upside keys and a big upward dynamic. And I was saying, just talking to myself this morning, I was drinking the last of the pu'er tea we bought in Fortnum and Mason last year, and I'm looking forward, or excuse me, last May, and looking forward to the chart seminar in a few weeks, where I'm definitely going to use the opportunity to walk over to Fortnum and Mason and buy some more. And back in May, it was looking hairy for gold because it had been ranging and it was looking susceptible to additional weakness. Now it's looking like it's susceptible to additional upside. The internal dynamics of the range are higher. If you just simply look at color coding, we've got more white candles than blue candles, and the white candles are bigger than the blue candles within this range that's been forming for the last 6 weeks. But one of the big missing ingredients for strength in gold has been dollar weakness. And just this week, we had the Federal Reserve saying that they are going to err on the side of caution, and they're going to raise rates into prohibitive territory because they view that as the risk management style, that they believe that there is less risk of over-tightening than there is of under-tightening because their primary fear is that inflationary pressures become entrenched. And what's particularly interesting is that since that statement, the dollar has been rolling over. So what investors are beginning to get their heads around is that the Federal Reserve is going to cause a recession, and recessions result in deflationary forces, and deflationary forces will represent a challenge for the Fed to continue to raise rates and to reduce the size of its balance sheet. And it will create demand for bonds. Now, we haven't yet seen the demand for bonds. The 10-year yield has not yet broken down through 4%. But there's the willingness to accept that perhaps it will. Now, at some stage, then, those events are going to happen. And then on the other side of the ledger, we have the demand question for commodities. And there's a lot of speculation right now about what's going to happen in China. But investors are willing to also think, well, on a risk-adjusted basis, perhaps it's not a bad time to buy Hong Kong. So we've had this really quite profound acceleration lower. And since the beginning of 2021, the H-share index, or the China Enterprises Index in Hong Kong, is down from 12,000 to 5,000. And we've had a good-sized rally in here this week. And this is an upside weekly key reversal. Now, it didn't finish on the high of the week, but if we get upside follow-through next week, then there's the likelihood that we could see a reversion back towards the mean. And that would be a move of about 1,500 points. It's also, I think, worth highlighting that the index is back in the region of the low from 2008. So I think lots of investors where there is the potential for a rebound and perhaps a question around the commitment of the Communist Party to COVID zero. But when valuations are this low, when the PE is 5 and the yield is 4, then you're not going to go too far wrong by buying value at this stage. So that's why investors are moving in to buy Chinese stocks. And then They're also looking at this, and I think this is almost algorithmic. We get strength in Chinese tech companies on the same days that we get weakness in US tech companies. So the CQQQ ETF was up in a really quite dynamic manner in here today. Not quite 10%, but really not that far off it. And this is a significant upward dynamic. And the size of the move on the downside has been really quite profound since the peak back in 2021. And the price is all the way back in the region of where it was in 2015. So there's the potential, at least, that we could get a reversion back towards the 200-day moving average. And that would be a pretty substantial move. Going from the low of 30 to around 45 is a 50% advance, and that's still within the confines of what's a reasonably consistent downtrend. Now, the big question, of course, is what's going to happen with China and its COVID zero policy? So, sentiment has been quite negative, and the renminbi has been devaluing. So, it was up in a dynamic manner in here today, and certainly now giving some evidence of support in the region of the lows and the peak for the dollar over the last 5 years. So, certainly scope for some pause and consolidation, probably in a manner similar to what we had in the middle of the year. So, we might see the rate come down into the 705 or even the 7 level. It's not like China's challenges have suddenly evaporated. The number of COVID cases is ramping higher, but it's concentrated in peripheral regions like Xinjiang and Inner Mongolia. Of the 1,000 publicized cases, about 700 of them are in Inner Mongolia. So, even though there was high-profile cases this week of Disneyland in Shanghai getting locked down and people having to queue, there was a joke going around that the longest queue in Disneyland on this occasion was to exit because you had to have a negative PCR test before they'd let you leave the compound. And of course, that's not confidence inducing. But there has been this discussion within the central government about how to increase the number of airlines that are arriving in China and potentially to remove the fines that are being imposed on airlines if they, unfortunately, if they bring in someone who is COVID infected into the country. So, quite how an airline is supposed to police that is probably one of the reasons why they're just deciding not to fly to China at all. So, China may be willing to allow some additional inward travel. They've certainly not been keen on allowing outward travel, and one of the things that they want to try and do is limit the ability of people to move currency outside the country. So, that's central to the aim of trying to support asset prices internally, but they can only do that if they avoid capital flight. So that's really one of the more significant issues. But with even a whiff of the potential that China will be more active in trying to support the economy, copper was up in really quite a dynamic manner, and it is closing out the week at the upper side of this range that's been forming now for about 6 months. So this is the most convincing evidence we've had yet that the lows for copper might be in. And this is, I think, quite an important development. So some of the copper miners have started to rebound, and we've certainly seen this big pop on the upside today from Fortescue Metals, excuse me, Freeport-McMoRan. I'm sorry, these I get these two names conflated in my head for some reason. But Freeport-McMoRan popping on the upside back above the 200-day moving average, having found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. That's really quite encouraging. There was a news item today that Fortescue is now the largest producer. It's overtaken Codelco because of the work stoppages and difficulties that Codelco has gone through. Southern Copper has also rebounded in really quite an emphatic fashion and clearing the $50 level. And it's also worth highlighting that the share yields about 7%. So we're talking about companies that have pulled back sufficiently that their yields are becoming more attractive. Then the big question, of course, is about have we seen the worst of the pessimism with regard to China? I think it's unlikely they're going to do away with the COVID zero mentality because they've invested so much political capital in trying to preserve the country from the pandemic that it's going to be very hard to walk away from that. And they're not engaging in a new mass vaccination program. They're not really engaging in a lot of measures that could be used to pass off the opening up of the economy. And that would suggest that what we're going to see are targeted measures. There's going to be exceptions made here and there, and airlines might be one of those. But it does suggest then that the peak of pessimism has been probably reached with regard to China in the short term. Now, how it all evolves over the longer term, and particularly as the number of COVID cases ramps higher over the next 3 months, is very much open to question. But as we've seen with every other country, it's not so much about the severity of the disease, but rather the severity of how public officials deal with it that have been the primary factor that has been incorporated into market pricing. So it's looking increasingly likely that these upward dynamics are breakouts, and we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside until proven to the contrary. Now, where it starts to become important for the entire global economy is with oil, because Brent crude is up today nearly $4 and finishing on the upper side of this range. We've been in this exceptionally tight range between $90 and $100 for the last month. We have a succession of higher reaction lows since the end of September. There is a succession of lower rally highs since the end of June. But let's just put this into perspective. Prices ramped higher in response to the invasion of Ukraine earlier on this year and have held above the $80 level. So we're at least in a range similar to what we had between 2011 and 2014. It's a bit more volatile than that, but certainly we're at least ranging. And this higher plateau level could hold out for longer because there hasn't been nearly enough of investment in new supply. So, and then the whole problem is that energy companies are very reluctant to make those longer term investments because they're convinced now that the governments of the world are intent on downsizing their businesses. So if they were to go off and make those decade-long investments, are they just simply going to have to write them off? And will they then be accused of failing in their fiduciary responsibility to shareholders if they were to go ahead and make those investments? So that suggests that we're not going to see a new investment cycle in energy until they get guarantees politically. And that is probably going to require changes of government in a number of jurisdictions. So oil could easily push through the $100 level next week. And if it does, it will have resolved this range Rangers are explosions waiting to happen. We could easily see prices pushing up towards 120, even 140 in the short term. If, on the other hand, prices fail next week and do not push back above the $100 level, well, then the deflationary forces that we see in several economies will have triumphed. But China is the majority consumer of commodities. So any outlook that is positive for Chinese growth, or at least less negative, is going to be positive for the commodity complex. We've had the big bull theme for commodities is that they have collapsed as a percentage of the market cap of various indices, so that they're underrepresented in ETFs. Therefore, they are less likely to be affected by the declines that we're seeing in some of the Fangman shares. At the same time, when we look at what the plans are for the next decade, there's massive infrastructure development that is completely necessary. And that's true because a lot of the infrastructure, particularly that the OECD relies on, was built 70 years ago, and it needs to be revitalized, replaced, or rebuilt. So that's absolutely inevitable. Then we have the worry about the climate. Now, if we really want to think about long-term phenomena, we've certainly seen a trend where there has been a drought in the Western USA for most of the last 20 years. And water in the Colorado River was greatly overestimated when it was initially allocated 100 years ago. And now it's seriously impacting the water levels in Lake Mead. So there's going to have to be a reorientation of water rights. Then this year was not the first year where the Rhine River coming out of Switzerland into Germany has had very low levels. So this is an additional challenge. Then what's also been very headline making over the course of the last year has been the Three Gorges Dam. Because a year ago, because of flooding, there was the risk that it was going to overtop. So that was when we had torrential rains. Then there was a drought this summer, and water levels were so low that they had to cut back on electricity production. So we're looking at really significant water events in all the main economies. And on top of that, you have this Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica, where there's new data coming out all the time, and they've just discovered a river running underneath the glacier. And the portion that is sitting above the water is apparently holding on by its fingertips. So eventually, that is going to break. And that's going to set off a wave of panic about the climate. And there's going to have to then be a very clear acceleration in both the provisions for coastal flooding, and on top of that, then the potential for geopolitical stress to increase. And on top of that, the need for energy independence. Now, we have a need for energy independence today, and that's very real. And I think it's been brought home to every government in Europe that there is an acute need to come up with a plan for energy independence. Because at the present moment, you have Germany building LNG at terminals to receive cargoes, and they're substituting reliance on Russian gas for US and Qatar gas. And Australia will continue to supply countries like Japan, South Korea, and China. But that's only substituting reliance from one country to another. Then there's still the plan in the UK to build an array of solar panels in Morocco and then cable that electricity from Morocco back up to the UK. And of course, not only is that transferring reliance onto another country, but it's leaving a very long cable exposed to interference by a third party. And considering that the Nord Stream pipeline has been punctured, then that brings home the reliance on pipelines and long undersea cables. That's just makes it the point abundantly clear that these are legitimate military targets. And in a geopolitically uncertain environment, you want to limit your risk, not increase your risk. So it is more likely than not we're going to see continued investment in nuclear power plants. And Poland is investing in their first one and gave the contract to Westinghouse. But the uranium ETF hasn't really rallied yet. Now, it was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today, but that was right off the open and didn't hold it. But it is, I think, certainly more likely than not that what we're looking at right now is a first step above the base. Then, when we think about where are we going to come, or where are we in this cycle? Well, the investment theory, or the investment themes that are likely to drive the recovery out of this period of monetary tightening, are looking increasingly clear. It's going to be more about commodities and infrastructure, building, but building likely to be controlled by governments, not private sector investment. There will certainly have to be public-private investments, and that's likely to be the next tier of private investment. So there's been a lot of money that's been printed over the course of the last decade, and a lot of it has found its way into these private funds. So there's some really good charts in this PGIM report. So we can see, for example, that finance companies stopped investing in the ABS market in 2008, so that was taken over by private companies. And then banks just stopped lending to corporations, so going from about 70% down to about 30%, and that's been taken over by private investors. Now, the more you look at these kinds of moves where private money going into energy has gone from basically nothing in 2003 to significant money, 61 billion in 2021. Well, what this is basically telling us is that private money has taken over the riskiest portion of the market, of the fixed income markets. So banks no longer have the concentration of risk that they would have over the long term. The search for yield that took place after 2008 meant that it's mostly private money, which is really a euphemism for pensions, endowments, and sovereign wealth funds are now the primary. And then, of course, the alternative asset management sections of investment banks. Well, there was a, I saw an article today that somebody at Goldman was recommending that people have 30% of their assets in collectibles. So we've had a rip-roaring bull market in the price of collectibles in all kinds of limited supply assets over the last 14 years. And that has been fueled by the fact that interest rates have been exceptionally low. Now, the reason that I think that that's not going to be the leading asset class in the next decade is because we now have a discount rate. And when we look at the just very simply, the long-term chart of the Fed funds rate, well, we've broken the sequence of lower rally highs. And I think it is likely that before we get to the end of this interest rate hiking cycle, we will have broken back above the 5% level and taken out the peaks from 2006 and 7. But even then, I don't think that's the most important factor. I think by far the most important factor is that we're going to get a higher reaction low. That after we see interest rates start to come back down, they will bottom above a quarter of 1%, and instead probably bottom around 2%. And subsequently, the next time we see a hiking cycle, the peak will be above the peak from this cycle, and that we are now in a new kind of inflationary environment. So let's just think about what were the main factors of the big bull market from 2008 to 2022, and realistically the end of 2021. Well, the first one was exceptionally cheap money. So we had no discount rate, abundant credit, central banks that increased the size of their balance sheets by trillions at a time, pumping that money out into the system, and artificially depressing interest rates, effectively robbing savers and turning everyone into a speculator. So that phenomena where private assets are now the predominant lender to mortgages, to the high yield sector, and into the collectibles sector. These are all high risk activities, and they have had to move further and further out the risk curve. So the real epicenter of risk in this environment, where we're not just seeing a flash in the pan in terms of inflation and of interest rates rising, but rather that this could potentially be a longer term cycle, where we get many peaks and troughs, and we get shorter investment cycles, but that over time the discount rate comes back in, and it will become more rewarding for private assets to migrate away from the private sector and go back into the bond market because the bond market will offer higher yields, then that's going to be exceptionally problematic for those private assets. So some sectors are going to come under exceptional duress. Now, to the extent that pensions are backstopped by governments, then it's going to represent a significant draw on government finances. When we look at local governments being responsible for local pensions, it means there'll be a significant deterioration in services, or there will be additional taxes imposed to recapitalize some of those pensions. And then ultimately, there will have to be some form of renegotiation with public sector unions that people are going to have to start working for longer. And everyone thinks about 65 years being the retirement age, but that is not even remotely close to the truth. That a teacher, and I'm speaking with someone whose wife is a teacher, and she's already talking about retiring, and she's not 50 yet. She anticipates retiring at 55 because at that stage she'll have been a teacher for 30 years. And then she will secure 80% of her income for ever, and 80% of the highest average, I think it's not the highest income ever, but at the average of her highest 2 years of income ever for the rest of her life. So you basically go to school for 15 years, or I guess if you want to include college, you go to school for 20 years, you work for 30 years, and then you might live for another 30 years without having to work at all. And these kinds of events were and agreements were possible because we had perpetually lower interest rates, abundant credit, money printing that was never an issue, and governments that were not inhibited from increasing spending. Well, if interest rates continue to rise and we move into a new inflationary cycle, then those kinds of sweetheart deals are not going to be sustained. I think one of the most important factors right now is that the USA is short of about 6 million workers. And the reality is that there's nobody willing to grasp that particular nettle within government. The baby boomer generation are retiring en masse, and the number of open jobs is still around 10 million. And I think the most important thing here is that you have a trend. It's been trending higher since 2009, and it really took off at the end of 2016, and that was the beginning of the Trump tax cuts. So not only did you have pro-cyclical spending, but you had an administration that took over that was deeply ambivalent to immigration. So immigration was 1 million people a year that was highly skilled legal immigration in 2016, and it's less than 200,000 now. And in that time, the number of open jobs has gone up by 6 million. So that's one way of counting. You've basically lost about 4 million people that would have immigrated, and now they haven't, and all those jobs have been left unfilled. On top of that, about 3% of the population has retired in the last 6 or 7 years, and that's another 10 million people. So you have natural increase, and you certainly have a lot of people walking over the border over the last year, but those people are illegal and they're not being counted. So that's also why the economy doesn't look like it's under as much stress as this official number highlights. But if there's a lack of skilled workers, then that pushes up wages over the long term. And of course, that also means more payroll income. And the reality then is that inflationary pressures don't come down, and that eventually the balance sheet will have to be corrected. Now, we know what's happened in the past. We know that the ECB took €1 trillion out of circulation. Interest rates went, or excuse me, bond yields went up and then collapsed. The Federal Reserve did it in 2018 and 19 when they took $750 billion out of circulation. Yields went up, then collapsed. And now they are talking about accelerating the pace of the balance sheet runoff. But it is still coming down rather slowly. So bond yields aren't yet coming down. And there's no question they have gone up a lot. But the balance sheet runoff really hasn't picked up pace yet. But the deflationary shock is out there in the future, that you cannot simply raise rates indefinitely. You can't have the yield curve spread continuing to go negative. And the 10-year minus the 2-year has been negative now for months. It first went inverted in March of this year, and it's been inverted since June. And the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month was inverted last week and then popped back up again this week. But still exceptionally low levels. Now, one of the things that is very pressing is how do you manage a bond portfolio when interest rates are going up this quickly? So Let's just pay attention to the fact that the Fed funds rate right now is about 4%. So what you have to do first is you can look at bond yields, and the 3 month is at about 4.1%, and it hasn't jumped higher despite the fact that it is very likely in December they're going to raise rates again. But what definitely happened following the previous interest rate hikes is people put their money in 3 months and they hold it there for about 6 weeks. Then yield, they start to sell it out because they're pricing in, they don't price in the interest rate hike immediately, but rather the demand for short-dated bonds tends to inflate. Because of the inflated demand, it tends to deflate the pressure on yields rising. So it's very likely we're going to see the 10-year minus 3 month invert even more in December, but not right away because of this outsized demand for near cash money when rates are rising this quickly. So what we are being primed for right now is a deflationary shock that we're going to see unemployment begin to rise, companies cutting back on expansion, and if commodity prices continue higher from here, real panic among central banks about inflationary pressures that are beyond their control. So then that's going to be really a very significant factor in over tightening, that they will panic about not, because most of the issues that the USA has been facing in terms of inflation, particularly over the last 6 months, have been about demand. But if commodity prices push higher from here, then that's going to reintroduce issues regarding inflation and being about supply. And that's going to cause a degree of panic. So what I anticipate is we're going to have a more volatile environment on the stock market. And when we look then at the Nasdaq, we've had a really quite a volatile day. So the price was up in early trading, then gave it all up. And now, as we approach the close, it is rebounding once more. And we're oversold, so potentially it's going to push higher from here. But the most important thing here is that the Nasdaq is encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And then let's think about companies like Amazon, which has now broken downwards. Now, it's really oversold in the short term, but that's a really clear break below 100. Meta Platforms has continued to extend its downtrend. Now, the valuation on Meta has improved a lot, and the estimated PE is at less than 10. So there's definitely value coming in here. Now, eventually, they might, Mark Zuckerberg might be encouraged to abandon his ambitions regarding virtual reality. And if you were to do that, I would anticipate that the share would probably rise about 30% overnight. But what we're seeing right now also is that today's the 4th of November. So we only have 2 months left, or less than 2 months left before the end of the year. And tax selling is underway. So, generally, during the tax selling season, what happens is the worst performing stocks go down even faster. So, what I find interesting here is that there are a number of companies on this list that actually do make money. PayPal is one of them. Now, PayPal is the kind of company that suffers when interest rates are rising aggressively because it hits consumer demand. But they have free cash flow of 5.6 billion, cash of 10 billion. So And when you start looking at free cash flow relative to enterprise value, you're coming up with a really quite a chunky free cash flow yield. And DocuSign, well, people actually use DocuSign, and it's not like the company has a completely useless product, but they are still in an environment where investors are not convinced, but they have free cash flow of 440 million on an enterprise value of about 8 billion. So, that's a 5% free cash flow yield, and it's not like the company's going to disappear. So it's not like all the companies that are going down in an aggressive manner are going to disappear. And Match.com has been trending downwards since the end of 2021, coming from 180 to 40. And this company dominates the dating app sector. So they have, I suppose, a fair amount of money on the market cap and not all that much debt, and free cash flow of about 480 million. So it's not like these companies are going to go bust. There are companies out there that could go bust. Peloton is certainly one of those, and I just have I don't think I'm a fair judge of Zoom communications. I just feel emotional about it. But these companies aren't going to go bust. Some of them will eventually start paying dividends. I think Facebook could, or Meta platforms could easily begin to pay a dividend at some stage. But we are seeing accelerations lower for a number of these companies. And that is a response to tax loss selling. And what we'll often see is at the beginning of the next year or in the last week of this year, it would be quite normal to see a rebound starting in some of these very oversold companies, because anyone who wants to sell will use the next 6 or 7 weeks to do so. And then subsequently, we'll get a rebound. And that will probably be the beginning of the base formation environment, or the base formation beginning for a lot of these innovation type companies, because a lot of the bad news will have already been priced in. But then let's think about other companies. So Caterpillar has rebounded in really exceptional fashion in here this week. So that's implying that there's going to be more building, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a lot more building of residential property, but perhaps there's going to be a lot more building of mining activity, and that this desire to become energy independent and to pioneer a new energy environment is something that's going to require huge spending on infrastructure. And I think investors came around to the idea this week that China is really important, and that if China's economy just simply steadies, that removes a lot of the negativity around commodity prices. And if China just steadies, and it removes some of the doubt about the outlook for the Chinese economy, and then a lot of the pent-up demand and the want, and I guess the investor desire to buy into the idea that we are moving into a new energy environment, that there will absolutely have to be greater investment in new infrastructure, that infrastructure plays will generate sufficient cash flows to offer a respectable return to investors. But then the other point is that the dollar has been exceptionally strong for the last 2 years, and in just the same way that we've had two upside key reversals and a big upward dynamic for gold, well, For the dollar, we've had three downside Q reversals. And I think it's worth highlighting that today is Friday, and we've had a big selling pressure on the dollar. And then last week we had some steadying. Then, if we go back and think that it was another Friday that we had this downside Q reversal, what we're seeing is that people don't want to hold dollars over the weekend. So it's going to be really important that if we see additional interest in shorting the dollar at the beginning of the week rather than the end of the week, the dollar index needs to hold the lows around 110 if the uptrend is to remain consistent. A midpoint danger line stop somewhere around the 107.5 level would really break the uptrend. And if it comes back below the 200-day moving average, well, then the break of the uptrend will be completely incontrovertible. If we're moving into a deflationary environment, which is quite likely in the first half of 2023, the dollar will decline. And that will also be not great news for Wall Street. So we could easily see lower prices, lower valuations on Wall Street as a result of dollar weakness, because it might flatter the results for internationally oriented companies, but it's going to remove the desire of international investors to just pile into US assets in the first place. And then if we just think about emerging markets, well, if the dollar rolls over and commodities do well, then it is very likely that emerging markets will also do well. India continues to push up out of its range. We're in a really charmed environment for India, where they have hundreds of millions of young people, a services sector that's already well developed, and a manufacturing sector that is growing quickly. And then in a geopolitically important location, which is being used as a bulwark against Chinese expansion. So India is a country that has got a lot going for it. And then because of the system of governance that it inherited from the British Empire, the stock market returns tend to be significantly better than were ever achieved in China. And that is despite some clear exceptions like the phenomenal growth we've seen in Tencent over the course of the last decade. Then another country likely to benefit from rising geopolitical tensions is Indonesia. And the Jakarta composite is hovering here in the region of the all-time peak. And this looks like a first step above this range that formed between 2018 and 2021. Brazil has just had their election, and the stock market there is firming. It hasn't quite yet broken through the 120,000 level, but it is looking more likely than not with dollar weakness. The Brazilian real has base formation characteristics versus the dollar. It's held up better than just about any other currency internationally, and we certainly know that the Brazilian real has the potential to rally in an exceptional manner when commodities are in a bull market. So, if oil and copper break on the upside, then it would be quite normal to anticipate that the Brazilian real will rally in a big way. And just think that in 2002 it traded at 4, and by the time it bottomed, it was trading closer to one, or excuse me, by the time it topped, it was trading a lot closer to 150. So it had a bottom in May of 2020 at 6. That means that it could double. It could come all the way back into about the 250 area during a big commodity bull market. So that would be really transformative for Brazilian equities. And that, of course, is entirely dependent on commodity prices continuing to do well from here. And then Mexico, with a land border with the USA and commodity exports and the potential for battery manufacturing to take over, or some of the pressure from the automotive sector and the Bovespa, excuse me, the Mexpol index is pushing higher here in quite a dynamic manner in here this week. So some countries are definitely going to do better in a weaker dollar environment, higher interest rate, better commodity market environment. I don't think that China, despite the very low valuations, is going to be a home run. I think it's a trader's market, not an investor's market. It is certainly not the kind of place you can go and just leave your money and never and look at it again. But it's oversold in the short term, and there's certainly the potential for a rebound and a reversion back towards the mean. After that, we still have to address the questions about governance, about the rise of authoritarianism, but most importantly, the sanctions that are increasingly being imposed upon China, and how difficult it's going to be to invest there from the perspective of a foreign investor over the course of the next decade. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.